Welcome in, folks. It is Friday, and this is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader, and we are creeping along to the weekend. I want to remind everybody that my weekend, no, is not over. I will be on KNSI Radio tomorrow, not doing anything paranormal, just kind of helping you through your Saturday morning. I'll be doing a news block tomorrow and anchoring the news block. So if you're running the kids around to different sporting events and whatnot, you just want to hear my cheery voice tell you about the weather, the sports, and what happened in your overnight or what happened on Friday night, and you want to listen to something out of Minnesota, I'll be on KNSIRadio.com. That's where you can listen to me around the nation, around the world, and hear my cheery little voice. You can do that by going to KNSIRadio.com between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. Central Time. That's KNSIRadio.com. Also, Independent Wrestling International returns in 1 month. March 17th, Cloverleaf Carnage is the name of the card. I am your general manager and your evil general manager at that, and ring announcer for the event. We've got an exciting card out there for St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. First of all, it starts with the world's smallest St. Patrick's Day parade in Hopkins. I don't know if you knew that or not, but it's happening in Hopkins. And we start with that, and then at 7:30 bell time, 6:45 is when doors open there at the Hopkins American Legion. We'll start the card from there. And we've got a U.S. title defense by Tommy Spiderbaby Saturday. It is a title versus mask match with El Tigre, along with much, much more. Check us out on our Facebook page or on our Twitter page at IWI Pro for more information. And I'll be giving you more details as we get closer to the card. But we're in Hopkins now at the American Legion. And it is kicking off March 17th. So 1 month from now, tickets are available at the door. $12 for adults, $8 for kids. Again, IWI is back and in Hopkins on St. Patrick's Day. Also, if you want to check out where Dave and I are around the country, around the world, you can go to darknessevents.com. Dave has an event coming up in Romania in September, and tickets are still available, but going fast for that. Make sure that you check that out. And Dave and I will be at Michigan Paracon as well in August. Tickets are going quickly for that as well. Again, darknessevents.com to see where Dave and I are going to be around the nation for all different types of paranormal events. Let's get into today's program, shall we? Because we've got an exciting one. Our friend David Weatherly is back with us, and he's got some exciting developments as to what's going on in his life. There's always something exciting going on with David Weatherly, and we do have an update on Black Eyed Kids, and we do have a very creepy encounter with Black Eyed Kids coming up on Theater of the Mind. So let's bring in right now our good friend David Weatherly. Hi, David. How you doing?
Hey, Tim. I'm great. How about you?
Doing good. I kind of skipped the bio portion because I wanted to get straight to today's program. And we're going to talk in the second part of the program about an interesting location that you've discovered that's got some very, very haunted activity. And we'll get into that in the second half of the program. Let's talk a little bit now. The Black Eyed Children book that you first came out with has been revised, correct?
That's correct. The revised edition came out, actually, it just got in under the wire at the end of last year, and there was a particular reason I wanted to do that. I originally published the book in 2012, so 2017 was not only 5 years since the book had been released originally, but it was also the 20-year anniversary of Brian Bethel's encounter. And you know, it's just kind of mind-boggling that it's been that long in some ways. His account is probably the most iconic of Black Eyed Kid encounters. If anybody's heard of the phenomena, you know, the odds are they've heard at least of that encounter. Mm-hmm. Because he kind of started the modern wave of these sightings, so to speak. And the revised edition of the book, it has a couple of new things. It has a new cover by artist Sam Sharon, who just really knocked it out of the park with this one. It's you know, go on and at least look at the image. It's some creepy kids standing at the door waiting to get in, and kind of gives you the chills when you see it. It also, the book also has a new chapter. It's called Brian Bethel 20 Years Later, and it's a dialogue that I had with Brian, basically with him reflecting on the effects of the encounter that he had with these kids, and you know how it still sort of lingers in his life, so to speak, and also some reflections on what he thinks, you know, this much further on, what he thinks the children actually are, you know, or where they're from. And like the rest of us, he doesn't have any solid answers. It's just speculations. But, you know, his encounter was just so creepy and sort of set the precedent for a lot of the accounts to come.
You know, I mean, without getting too much into what Brian's reactions are in the book, I want to ask you a little bit about his psychological makeup 20 years later, because it seems to me, and we keep hearing from people about who have had these encounters and haven't realized until now that they've had these encounters, David, and that's, I guess, what the creepiest thing of all is. You know, one of the black-eyed kid encounters that we had heard about recently, and that we'd done a Theater of the Mind on, the person in question that had had the encounter thought that they had encountered something completely different. In fact, they had chalked it up to a completely different type of entity, and then said, "Wait a minute, it wasn't a they chalked it up to vampires of all things."
Right.
After having watched Salem's Lot, and they had this totally different mindset of what it was that they had seen based on a Hollywood movie. And now, you know, things that there we see on television or things that we see in Hollywood movies that we might have been influenced by, people are going back and going, you know what, now that I've heard of Black Eyed Kids, I think maybe I actually had an encounter of that. Brian's now had this encounter, and 20 years later, it's kind of like when you're looking at things in the rearview mirror and you see it and you're a little bit jaded or you're psychologically detached from things. Does Brian still have that fright factor 20 years later, or does he look back on it? And even though he may be chilled by it, he can look back on it and kind of dissect it a little bit easier.
I hesitate to speak for him completely, but through dialogue that I've had with him, I can tell you that there's still a tremendous effect from this experience. And he still, you know, the psychological factor. First of all, let me back up a little bit, actually,
sure,
and
sure.
Say, you know, for those not familiar with this encounter, the brief version of it is that Brian, he went out one evening to make a payment, was going to drop a check in an after-hours box, and went to a strip center. This was in Amarillo, Texas. Was sitting his car writing the check out when these two kids approached his vehicle, and he had this experience where he said initially he just felt a little bit uneasy. Now, he wasn't in a bad neighborhood or anything like that. These kids didn't look like, you know, gangbangers or anything like that, but there was something off right from the get-go. And this is actually where the beginning, I think, of the psychological component comes in these experiences, because almost universally the people I speak to who have these encounters, they talk about these three stages. The initial stage of just feeling somewhat uneasy, which rapidly develops into nervousness, you know, and that's right when the flight impulse is starting to kick in. And then, of course, it fully comes in, you know, they experience this rush of fear and they run away from these kids or they slam the door or whatever the case may be. So Brian, you know, he was the first one to openly report this sequence of events. And again, 1997, in the aftermath, he posted his encounter and he talked about how these kids made him uneasy. He only rolled his window down a little bit and he started this dialogue with them. But it was very awkward because they were saying things like, we just need to go see our mother. We need to get our money we want to see a movie. Brian had the state of mind to glance over at the marquee and realize that the movie was already half over, so things weren't really adding up. You know, the language was very awkward these kids were using, and the nervousness grew. And then when he made full-on eye contact, with these kids, he realized they had solid black eyes, and the flight response kicked in. So, you know, he shoved the car into gear and tore out of the lot. And when he looked in the rearview mirror, these kids had vanished. So, you know, those simple things on the surface, a lot of people just say, well, you know, it's no big deal. It's just kids playing a hoax or something like that. No, the psychological component really comes in because of what Brian experienced and what other people experience when they encounter these children. The sequence that unfolds, you know, it really disturbs people to the point that psychologically they often develop a lot of symptoms in the aftermath. You know, I've talked to people who develop insomnia, who develop a constant state of nervousness. They have reactions when someone knocks on the door. You know, so all these things that come in that influenced the person for a long time afterwards. For Brian, it was actually a little bit more heightened simply because he stepped out in 1997, posted his account on the internet, and then he was completely inundated with people writing to him and emailing him and posting on the forum and saying, you know, I've experienced this. I had something similar. You know, all these other stories started to come out. And of course, you know, hundreds of people barraged him with questions, and, you know, they wanted to interview him. They wanted to talk to him personally because, you know, they wanted to get some answers. They wanted to share their experience. Brian got so inundated that he couldn't deal with it for a time, and he just kind of shut everything down. He wouldn't answer any emails. He wouldn't address the topic. He just kind of tried to stay off the radar completely. In terms of this topic for a long time. And in fact, even as late as 2010, when I was researching material for the book, you know, I tried a couple of times to reach out to Brian, and he just wouldn't respond to me. So as a result, the first edition of the book, you know, I discussed his encounter and talked about the implications of, you know, him kind of opening up and allowing other people to share their experiences, but I couldn't have a personal dialogue with him. And it was only probably a year or two after the book came out that Brian actually reached out to me and said, you know, I've read your book and I really appreciate it. And, you know, we started a dialogue at that point, and he started kind of opening up more, and now he is a bit more willing to talk about it to a degree, but it still, it greatly disturbs him. And the, you know, I was really appreciative of the chapter I was able to add to the new edition of Black Eyed Children with him discussing the continued ramifications of that experience.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the actual phenomenon of black eyed children. You know, in the time that since the book initially came out to now, when it's been revised, looking back, I mean, there's a lot of speculation as to what these things are, but do you lean one way or another as to what you think the phenomena is? I mean, you know, we've heard everything from demonic to aliens to, you know, any type of phenomena. Do you have a way that you lean one way or another as to what you think it might be?
Well, sure. Of course I do. You know, I developed that from the initial research of the topic. And, you know, I intentionally did not put that in the book because the phenomena, as you say, one of the strangest factors is that it can be compared and kind of compartmentalized into so many different types of phenomena. You know, you could easily argue it's demonic, or that it's an alien hybrid, or that it's connected to, you know, the djinn or the men in black, all these different things. So what I tried to do when I initially wrote the book was present the different theories and sort of almost play devil's advocate in each chapter and say, this is why it could be, you know, demonic. This is why it could be the djinn. And I wanted people to make up their own minds. I think it worked because, you know, the people I've spoken to in the aftermath, it seems to have. But honestly, throughout my research and interviewing so many people that have had these experiences, I kind of default back to the idea that these things are some kind of interdimensional entities. And, you know, some people, they get a little bit jacked up at that concept. You know, oh, you're talking about portals and they're coming from another world and all this stuff. But, you know, it doesn't sound as out there as it used to, because now even quantum science is talking about other levels of existence. You know, gosh, like 10 years ago, quantum theories came out and said, oh, we've figured out there are 12 other dimensions. You know, we don't know what's there or how to get there, but we know they exist. So, you know, the question in my mind has always been, okay, well, just because we can't get there doesn't mean that something there can't get here. And what's fascinating is when you read or listen to these accounts of these kids, there's so many strange factors, but one of them that really stands out to me is how many people experience these things where they're there one moment and they're gone the next.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, that kind of borders into the range of maybe they're a ghost or apparition, but then all of these people will swear, no, these things were solid, they were physical. You know, there's been a couple of people that have touched them. There's too many components that take it away from the ghostly realm and, you know, focus on these being some kind of physical beings. And, you know, we're not talking about people that have out and had a few drinks or something. I mean, we're talking about military personnel, law enforcement officers, you know, trained observers, mm-hmm. who, you know, take their eyes off these kids for, you know, a matter of seconds, and then they're gone. And that's always been one of the most fascinating components of these encounters to me.
You know, one of the other things, too, that always seems to get me, and I don't know why it gets me, even in today's theater of the mind, there's the mention of they're in a space 1 second and boom, they're right on top of you the next. And it seems like every story I hear, there's the talk of how quickly they move. Yet when you hear a talk of a ghost or a ghostly apparition, it doesn't seem to move like from here to there, bing bing. You know, it floats across the room, or it approaches you slowly, or the apparition just kind of materializes in front of you. It has a slower moving feel to it, whereas it seems like these things follow you across town quickly, or they're on top of you, like it's popping from one portal to the next, or it's just kind of a porting in front of you. And it gives that feel that you know, that this thing is just popping out of nowhere, or it knows where you're going to be before you're going to get there, not in a it's reading your mind type of thing, but maybe it does have some sort of a feel over time and space, like, you know what, we've seen this movie before, we know where you're going, we're just going to meet you at that place.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that is a very disturbing component, you know, and as you say, you know, if someone experiences seeing an apparition, you know, whether it's the ghost of a deceased relative or, you know, some other phantom from the past, there's still sort of a human component, isn't there? Because, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking about someone we either recognize or think we recognize, or, you know, someone that makes sense psychologically to the place we're in. You know, if we're in a if we're on a Civil War battlefield and we see what appears to be the phantom of a soldier, you know, from the Civil War, then it kind of makes sense. And, you know, even for non-believers, they kind of focus on, oh my gosh, you know, well, this is, you know, this looks like a soldier, you know, this. So again, there's that human component. And even when they move, while they might appear to float or something, there's something human about the entire nature of the thing. And for these encounters with these black-eyed children, it's sort of the opposite. You know, people are seeing something that appears human, appears to be a child, but it just isn't. And in fact, you know, we were talking earlier about the psychology, and another one of the fascinating components to these things for me is that I constantly hear people talk about this inner battle that they experience when these kids show up. And they have to try to deal with what appears to be a child asking for help, yet all the individuals in, you know, warning signs are kind of going off. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you get this inner psychological battle because, you know, as adults, we're basically hardwired to help a child.
Right.
You know, if you're Tim, if you're out on the street and a kid says, you know, Mister, I need help, I'm lost or something like that, your natural inclination is going to be to do something, you know, whether it's to try to do it yourself or to call police officer or whatever. But these people who experience these kids, they're having this situation where the kid is saying something akin to needing help. You know, I want to come in and watch television or, you know, bizarre things that are requests but don't necessarily make any logical sense. And then there's this inner battle going on because, you know, one guy told me when he experienced these kids, you know, they were asking, you know, they wanted to use the telephone or something. And he was talking about how, you know, the hair on the back of his neck went up and he felt, you know, like all of these things. He just felt really all the alarms were going off and he felt really disturbed because here's what appears to be a kid in front of him asking for help. But he's freaking out because, you know, he feels like he's in danger. And that's a weird psychological dynamic that gets created for these victims of these encounters.
Now, let me play devil's advocate, literally or figuratively, I guess, with you here, David. You're going to have people who, and I know I'm going to have listeners who will throw this back at me as well, who will say, well, let's make the argument for demonic, because you do have people who argue that, you know what, with some of these sightings or encounters, you do have that rotten meat smell, or you do have the appearance of the demonic or the whole they need to be invited in order to be in order to take hold of you. There's certain rules that would suggest that there's a demonic element to the black-eyed kids. Why aren't, in your opinion, why aren't these things demonic?
Oh, I didn't necessarily say they weren't.
Okay.
I think we get into the semantics of, you know, what defines demonic and what defines an interdimensional entity. I mean, what if, the common understanding of something demonic is in reality something that's coming from another dimension, you know, another level of existence. So, you know, I think that the argument for the demonic actually is a very good one. I know a lot of people, you know, the two most popular theories for these things, hands down, are that they are either something demonic or that they're some kind of alien hybrid. Mm-hmm. And while the arguments are interesting for alien hybrids, I don't buy into that hypothesis. I lean much more towards the demonic realm in terms of identifying what these things are, but I really go into the interdimensional entity. Doesn't mean that the two are exclusive. Now, what's interesting is that, as you pointed out, you get into the quote rules of demonology, so to speak, and we find a few interesting things. One, that, you know, the demonic purportedly can never take complete human form. Something has to be misshapen or right. Mangled. So it might be a hand or a foot. Why wouldn't it be the eyes?
Right.
And, you know, then you get into this concept that demons can't enter without some kind of invitation. And that's always the primary thing that occurs in these encounters. These kids, they want to be invited inside, whether it's inside a home or business or a vehicle. So, you know, that to me, it is incredibly fascinating. And again, I think we're bordering into some kind of entities from another dimension that maybe in the past people started identifying these things as demons, and that's how we've come to understand at least a portion of what we're dealing with.
So, you know, we like to compartmentalize our monsters, I guess, and to me, I guess we've always thrown this argument into either or, either alien or demonic, but we really shouldn't, huh?
I don't think we should, and, you know, I think that is sometimes a problem in the field in general, is that people want to compartmentalize as opposed to taking a more holistic view. And that goes back a long time. I mean, when I first got interested in these things, you know, the 1970s, a lot of my early influences People like John Keel and Jacques Vallée, you know, they took a more open view to phenomena in general, mm-hmm. and looked at the idea that maybe there is some kind of interaction. But what happened was, over the years, you know, all these organizations sprang up and different groups that focus on particular phenomena. And you get this dynamic where, you know, if someone calls in and they want to report that they saw a UFO. And, oh, by the way, we also saw a Bigfoot. You know how worked up that gets organizations like MUFON and the Bigfoot groups? Oh, my God. You know, because MUFON will start to listen and they'll say, no, we'll just deal with UFOs. You need to call the Sasquatch people, you know. And the Bigfoot people will say, no, we don't wear tinfoil hats. You know, we're looking for a physical creature. You need to go call the UFO people. So as a result, there are all these accounts that talk about different types of encounters at the same time. And you know, a lot of researchers get really worked up by that because, as you say, people want to compartmentalize. They want to isolate. And I think that, in general, we're dealing with a wide range of phenomena that we don't understand. And we need to be open to the idea that maybe some of this phenomena somehow works, you know, with each other or interacts or something. And, you know, it doesn't mean that UFOs are dropping off Sasquatches around the country. What it means is that, you know, we need to look at the idea that, you know, maybe there are places in this country or around the world that have a high concentration of strange things happening for a reason, you know, whether it's geological or geomagnetic or whatever. So, you know, I think with any phenomena, really it's important to look at different possibilities and be more open-minded as to what the explanation is. That's how we're going to get some answers.
You know, you brought something up interesting just a few minutes ago, and I want to throw this at you, or revisit it for a minute. You said something about you didn't think that these black-eyed kids were alien hybrids. And I guess I want to explore that for a minute with you. What do you think alien hybrids would be if we ran across one? Because, you know, when you look at things like grays and the stereotype that we have in our heads of grays, of these creatures being, you know, coming down and, you know, the thing with probes and cattle mutilations, and not necessarily being the nicest race out there. And then what we hear from, the different races of aliens, and the only thing seeming to be nice being the Nordics. What exactly are we running into with an alien hybrid, and what do you think an alien hybrid would be like as opposed to the black-eyed kids?
Man, that's a big question. I guess it's a very good question. And, you know, again, I guess to play devil's advocate with myself, even with what I was saying, mm-hmm. you know, there are a few researchers out there who think that the grays themselves are some type of demonic entity, you know, particularly people that have a more Christian foundation in researching some of this phenomena. So, you know, I accept that, well, you know, that could be a possibility. The whole thing is that these alien hybrids, if they're actually here, it kind of represents a very frightening prospect, because maybe they're just integrated into our society somehow. And, you know, this is what we're seeing. Honestly, I don't know what one would look like. Certainly the physical descriptions of the black-eyed children, you know, we kind of could compare that and say, well, yeah, maybe so. Maybe that's some kind of alien DNA. At the same time, the reason it doesn't work for me necessarily is that there seems to be an entirely different agenda with these black-eyed children. When they show up, I can't find a way personally to reconcile why they would be behaving this way if they were alien hybrids. Because when you look at these encounters, they seem to be coming in specifically in order to, I think, maybe feed on the energy that is created in the situations, because they come in and they create this extreme level of fear within people. And that's a very high emotion. And there's a concept that, you know, there are some things that could actually feed on that type of energy.
Go ahead.
So what's interesting to me is that, you know, in most of these encounters, when these kids show up, they create this high spike of fear within the victim. and then they're gone. You know, then they it's as if mission accomplished. They just vanished after that.
I was going to say, not only mission accomplished, but the few people that do disappear that you never hear from again, maybe the ones that do take the invitation, what do you surmise happens to them? You know, because obviously there's a mission there when they ask for the favor of can you help us, and someone does take that invitation, where do you suppose they go?
Gosh, you know, I honestly have no idea. I mean, that is... that's a pretty disturbing prospect to even think about. And when you consider how many people disappear on a regular basis in this country, you know, even if most of them go down to people just wanting to vanish or crime or whatnot, you know, there still may be a factor in there that is the result of something we don't completely understand. It's interesting because years ago, I think, you know, the first time Whitley Strieber interviewed me about this phenomena, one of the first things he said was how disturbed he was at the prospect that there were people who had accepted the invitations and the thought of, you know, what happened to them? You know, where are they? Where did they go? We don't know.
And it is disturbing to think that, you know, I've always kind of tied this in my head and wondered. When you look at the missing 411 phenomena and you see some of the disturbing after effects maybe of some of the things that have happened there, and you wonder maybe that's some of the after effect of what's happened with the Black Eyed Kids phenomena. Maybe they're tied together. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
You know, it's definitely a mystery that may never get solved, and maybe someday somebody will trip across something like that and actually put two and two together and make four. With that being said, we do have Theater of the Mind, and it is a Black Eyed Kids story, and let's go to that now. This is The Kids Are Not All Right.
The Dark Hives have given way to the Dark Eyes. This is a real Black Eyed Kid encounter, as shared by listener Jeff Gilbert. The Kids Are Not All Right. My name is Jeff, and I was recently reminded of something that happened to me when I was a college student, something that I just couldn't forget, something I wish I could forget. The whole thing terrified me so much, I try not to think about it, but, well, here we go. My dad had died when I was young, and my mom worked hard just to provide the basics for my brother and me, so there was no money set aside for college. However, I was determined to get a degree. I had good grades and received some scholarships, but I still had to work two jobs while I was in college just to meet expenses. One of my jobs was at a local little movie theater. It was a small private theater that showed older movies, offered cheap ticket prices, lower cost snacks, you know what I mean. I not only was the projectionist, but I also had to clean the theater after every final show. I was always alone when I did this, since the person who sold tickets and snacks was allowed to leave in the last 15 minutes of whatever movie was showing. One night, after the late show, I rewound the last movie reel and headed down to start cleaning up the spilled popcorn, drinks, wrappers, and other junk that were left under the seats. When I put the bright overhead lights on, I was startled to see two people were still sitting in the front row.
"Hey there!" I called. "Time to go home! Last show!"
I started sweeping the top row, expecting they would get up and go. But after a minute or so, I noticed they hadn't moved. I couldn't really see them very well, but they looked like they were youngish teenage kids. They had their heads together like they were whispering to each other.
"Time to go!"
I called again, starting to get a creepy feeling. I bent down to pick up a soda cup, and suddenly, the creepy feeling got worse. I stood up and was shocked to find the two kids standing right behind me. They had gotten from the bottom row to the top row really fast, without making any sound. I think I cried out in surprise. I don't really remember. I definitely felt a tingle of fear tighten all the way up my back. I realized how big and empty this theater was, and remembered I had left my phone in my coat pocket up in the projector area. Here were these two kids standing in the row of seats with me. They kept their heads down. The younger one, a boy, was wearing a hoodie, and the other, the older one, was a girl who had a black winter hat pulled over low on her brow. Then the girl spoke.
"Can you give us a ride?"
she said.
Our mom doesn't know where we are, and we need a ride.
They still kept their heads down, not really looking at me. There was something definitely off about these two, and my heart was beating really fast, and not in a good way. No, sorry, I said, trying to be polite. But even though I wanted to shove them away or pee my pants or something, I kept speaking. I have to finish cleaning up here. Then they took a step closer.
Please,
the girl said again.
Please, we don't have a taxi and we're scared.
The oddness of what she said hit me. It just was a weird thing to say. And I was about to say no again. But then I suddenly started thinking, I really should help them out. It was as if something in my head was saying, go ahead, help them, it'll be okay. They both took another step closer to me. Feeling them so close snapped me out of thinking I should help them. No, I said sternly, backing away down the aisle, trying not to trip in the tight space. I swear I was holding the broom out in front of me like some kind of sword. No, you have to go. I have work to do. I got to the end of the row and hurried up the aisle. I wanted to get the hell out of there, so I ran into the projection booth and shut the door. When I looked out through the window into the theater, there was no sign of them. They were just gone. It took me a while to get the nerve to go back out into the theater. I was afraid they would be waiting outside the projection room door. I wanted to call my roommate, but it was after 1 a.m., and I didn't want to wake him up and piss him off. I finished cleaning as fast as I could, and I locked up. I had to walk about a block to my car, and it was not the best neighborhood. So I walked down the middle of the street, looking left and right and listening for anything strange. Just as I got to my car, I happened to glance back down toward the theater. That's when I saw them, standing under a streetlight, the two kids. I got into my car as fast as I could, and I locked the door. I was just about to pull away when they were suddenly at my driver's side window. They were just kind of hanging their heads, not really looking at me.
Please,
the girl said again.
Please, we're lost and my brother's hungry.
Just then, they both looked up. They stared me directly in the eyes for the first time. That's when I saw their eyes were totally black. I mean, no eye whites at all. Their whole eyes were totally black. I just yelled, no! And I took off out of there. When I turned the corner to head out of the highway, I looked back, but there they were, still standing right where I left them, looking after the car. It took about 20 minutes to get back to my apartment. When I got there, I hurried inside, locked the door. My roommate was asleep, but I was too freaked out to sleep, so I sat up and played a video game for a little while. I had been playing for about 10 minutes when I heard a knock on the front door. It was three slow, solid knocks. I immediately got that creepy feeling again. I normally would just open up the door, but at that time of night, and after everything else that had happened, I decided to peek out from behind the living room shade. It was them, the boy and the girl. All I could think was, how did they know where I live? How the hell did they get here so fast? The room I was in was dark, and I had not made a single noise. But even so, they both looked straight up at me. Again, I saw those dark, black, inky eyes.
Let us in,
they both said together.
Let us in.
I think I must have let out some pretty bad language, and I ran into my roommate. He did not want to wake up, let me tell you that. I finally got him up and told him there were some creepy kids outside who wanted to come in.
Just tell them to get lost,
he mumbled, starting to go back to sleep. No, you have to come, I said. These kids are messed up. Just come with me. We both went to that door. My roommate, who was very grumpy, threw open the door and said,
what?
But there was nobody there. My roommate glared at me.
You're an idiot,
he said, and he went back to bed. I don't really think I slept that night at all, and I'm sure I struggled through my classes the next day. I did tell my roommate the whole story the next day, and he pretty much said I was an idiot again and didn't have much else to say about it. I've never forgotten that night. I have so many questions. Who were those kids? What did they want? How the hell did they move so fast? And what would have happened had I let them into my apartment? Well, that's it. That's my encounter with the Black Eyed Kids.
Beyond the darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader. Our guest is David Weatherly, and we are having a fascinating conversation, folks. Black Eyed Kids in the first part of the program. Now, in this part of the program, David has a brand new DVD that is set to come out shortly. It is called The Haunting of Sweet Springs, Weird West Virginia. And David, you along with Dave Spinks, have found a place in West Virginia, and I'm going to let you take over from here about talking about Sweet Springs. What exactly is Sweet Springs, and how did you come across it?
Well, this was an investigation conducted by Society of the Supernatural. It's a group that I co-founded with Dave Spinks. And Dave is a West Virginia native, so he spends a lot of time digging into the history of West Virginia and its hauntings and so forth. And he had learned about this place quite some time ago. The location is just, it's kind of mind-boggling, quite honestly, Tim. The history alone of this place, it was first, there was a building first on the property in the 1700s, the late 1700s. And it developed after that. It was surveyed by early settlers. William and Andrew Lewis, who were Revolutionary War figures, surveyed the land. They ended up having to forfeit the land to King George at one point, and then it was taken back over, of course, after the Revolution. By the early 1800s, they started building structures on the property. Now, the first structures that were there in the late 1700s and early 1800s were buildings that served as both a jail and a circuit court for the area. So it's actually one of the oldest jail buildings in the Alleghenies. I think the oldest possibly, and or in the Appalachians. This location is way down at the bottom of West Virginia, close to the Virginia border. It is a massive piece of property. The building that was put there in the early 1800s, I want to say like 1839, is 90,000 square feet.
Wow. That's huge.
It is massive. It was built as a resort. It was called Sweet Springs Resort. And it sprang up because there are all of these locations in West Virginia that have these healing springs, as they used to call them. Mm-hmm. And the belief was that the waters, because of their mineral content and so forth, would have all of these benefits to various things that people were suffering from. So they built this resort with the concept that people could come and spend time there and bathe in the springs and drink the waters and so forth and be healed from various conditions. So the property existed as a resort for quite some time. And eventually it ended up being a tuberculosis hospital when TB was so rampant. It was after that, it was a home for the elderly for quite some time. And eventually it was shut down. The state ended up owning it and basically did nothing with it. It was shut and abandoned for something like 20 years or so. Hmm. And it was eventually purchased just within the last few years by a group who wants to completely refurbish it and make a resort, a modern resort out of it, because of how picturesque and how amazing the property is. But again, excuse me, the history of this place is just amazing. I mean, looking at the people who visited the property during its heyday, it's like looking through a who's who list of history. We're talking about Washington, Jefferson, Robert E. Lee, a couple of different presidents visited the place, Pierce. It's it's incredible. And the structure itself was designed originally by Jefferson's protege, a guy named William Phillips. Hmm. Now, a lot of the rumors and sort of local lore in the area claims that the building was actually designed by Jefferson himself. And when you walk into the main entryway, it's, you know, you have to go in and look at some pictures of it. You'll see photographs, of course, on the DVD. Okay. But there are these high steps that go up to the main entrance. And when you walk inside the front of the main building, there is a massive mirror that was sort of one of the trademarks of Jefferson architecture. And then to the side, there's what's called a Jefferson fireplace. It's a specific design that was used in Jefferson's the buildings that Jefferson designed. So, you know, you get into this location, and the history itself, again, is just fascinating. There's a whole legend that Thomas Jefferson's African-American mistress came to the property to give birth. You know, it just it kind of goes on and on in terms of that type of lore.
So did this building at any time become a historical landmark, taken over by a historical society? Was anything like that done with this building?
Not really. You know, they've tried to do different things there over the years. A couple of people attempted to purchase a property. Somebody at one point wanted to buy it and make it a water bottling plant. You know, crazy things like that. Why it wasn't designated to be preserved as an historical site, I'm not completely sure. I think that part of the reason is it's such a massive complex, and the upkeep and the money required to refurbish it alone, you know, is kind of mind-boggling. I know that the people who purchased the property, you know, they're really gearing towards historical recognition of it and making it, you know, something that's functional but also pays tribute to it as a historical site. So I don't know how extensive the renovations are going to be. You know, we spent a lot of time there. We were there for several days and nights investigating the place, and we actually stayed on the property. But, of course, a lot of, you know, because it's an older building, I mean, there's areas that have asbestos and, you know, all these things like this that need to be cleaned up.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, of course, over the years, birds have gotten in and bats and things like that. So there's a lot of work to be done, but an amazing, amazing location. It really is.
You would think with the amount of space there, 90,000 square feet, and with the architecture that was there, I mean, mind you, you know, most of the mental institutions had gone away in the 80s, but that there would be, as you put it, there had been a health and wellness center at one time, that someone that was more well-to-do would have picked the building up for just pennies and turned it into some sort of resort.
Yeah, I think the problem was, you know, it was a retirement home up until the early 90s, I believe.
Okay.
Now, the state owned it in, oh gosh, the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they did some refurbishment, and, you know, then it became this retirement home for the elderly, like I said, up until I think the 90s. Then it was sold at auction at one point to some people who wanted to, as I said, turn it into like a bottling plant or something crazy. And then it was, I think they weren't able to do anything with it. So there's been all these different things. There was a council who did get involved, I think, with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they were trying to do some things there. And honestly, I don't know what all the ins and outs currently are of mm-hmm. its standing in terms of it being a designated historical location. But, you know, certainly the people who are currently in control of refurbishing, you know, they have history in mind in these terms, and they're all West Virginia natives, so, you know, I think they're going to treat the property right and do good by it.
So this seems like a building that would have more of a prestigious, with the exception of the, you said a key phrase here, tuberculosis hospital, which always seems yeah. to have the dun 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 in the background
right.
whenever you say that, you know, that that classic Hollywood effect. It seems to have more of a prestigious background. You would think, well, if there were hauntings there, maybe it would be kind of, you know, like a Stanley Hotel type of haunting, like, you know, a nice, friendly haunting. What exactly is going on there with paranormal history? What is going on at Sweet Springs?
Wow. So You know, as far as background, what happened was we had met the gentleman who was in charge of starting the refurbishment and the renovations of the site, and he agreed to let us in to investigate. So we went over, and as I said, we spent several nights, several days and nights on the property and had it completely to ourselves and started trying to dig in. Now, obviously, we're talking about a massive piece of property. You know, there was just no way to get to everything, of course. Mm-hmm. And we did have a special guest with us. We had Sean Austin from the Demon Files who was with us. So there were three of us trying to cover the property. But we also found that there are a lot of legends of some things going on the property when it was originally native land. So some of the activity may go back to that, and I'll tell you in a few minutes a couple of the stranger things that occurred.
Sure.
But as far as the paranormal history, you know, there are you know, they have security on location, they have cameras, security cameras and so forth, and there are all these reports that people were hearing of different activity in the building, some of it just being, you know, sounds, anomalous sounds, sometimes voices and things being moved and so forth. But the location is a beautiful piece of property, and there are people who will actually go there and walk past where the building is, and some of these people just simply out taking a walk or walking their dogs or whatever have reported seeing an apparition in one of the upper windows of what appears to be a woman. So that was one of the intriguing reports, that a particular room, they believe this woman appears in the window just sort of gazing out over the property. And, of course, we tried all kinds of things to, you know, see if there was an explanation for that. There's nothing in the room. There are no curtains. There's nothing like that that could explain that type of apparition. And some of the reports are, you know, people seeing this figure very, very clearly. It's a woman in period dress, and they think that maybe she's someone who passed away in that room. There are some strange things that the security people have seen on video. In fact, they allowed us to use a particular clip that you'll see in the DVD that they caught with one of their security cameras of something odd in a hallway. And there are some other strange things there too, you know, what people report as sounding like an animal in some of the areas. So it was an intriguing location for us, because the only reports basically are from, you know, a few security people and just a you know, some of the people in the area that have gone past the building, and of course a lot of legends and lore that surround the place, because it's been unoccupied for so long and it was closed down for so long. And there's a couple of rumors out there, because during the period it was abandoned, of course, you have, you know, people who don't really care about the rules, and they've, you know, broken there over time and tried to do things.
Right.
So, you know, there's a few scattered stories from some of those out there. But we had some pretty intense experiences in the place. We really did.
You know, what's interesting about a building that size, and the one thing I start thinking about too is I take it there's a lot of heavy materials that the building was built with as well. There's got to be a fair amount of marble, concrete, and with a building that size, it's got to be quite cavernous. Were you worried about, especially when you go to do sonic work, EVP work, that you're picking up a lot of vibration, or you're picking up a lot of echo, you're picking up things from down the hall that may be traveling, that may be just false positives?
Yeah, we try to account for that. And, you know, as a result, we tried to focus on some of the areas that we could control the environment a bit more, quite honestly. Now, we did do some work, you know, one of the outbuildings. First of all, most of the buildings are brick because of the time period. And we tried to do some work at one of the locations outside, because there's actually an area Looking down from the front of the main complex, there is a pond, and then there's another area that is bricked off, and it was an area where they had one of the actual springs is there in a pool, and people would go down and swim in there. And there's these brick archways that sort of lead into the area, and then there's a small building in the back that is rather decayed, where they used to have showers and changing rooms and so forth. But we even had some strange anomalies down there around the water, and voices coming across that were talking about people drowning and so forth. Now, we're talking about a site with a very, very long history. So obviously there have been some deaths there, even aside from the tuberculosis sanitarium period. So, that was sort of intriguing. But then inside the main structure, we tried to focus on a few of the locations that we felt were both historically relevant and also had, at least some reports or some indications of having activity. So we did a lot of work in the main entryway where the Jefferson mirror and fireplace are, and that was a little bit more controlled. Okay. There are hallways that go off of that main place, but we did some work there. We obviously did some sessions in the room where the apparition had been reported, and the upper hallways, which turned out to be really strange. But yeah, absolutely, you have to be careful. We have such a range of equipment that we try to adjust to the conditions and utilize what we know is going to work in terms of hopefully getting evidence in those situations.
Understandable. You mentioned the pool and the water out back. I got to ask you your theory on water as a source for spirits. I know a lot of people believe that when you have that source of running water, not only, the demonology theory of not only it being good to bind spirits or bind an evil spirit with that running water, but also having things like bodies of water or even limestone or different energetic sources being probably a good battery for spirits to get their energy to stay around, to be more active. Do you feel like Sweet Springs might have had a lot of those factors there?
Oh, absolutely.
What type of factors?
And I ascribe to that theory because, I've been in so many locations that had high levels of activity, and you often find some of those key components, whether it's a limestone foundation or, a lot of quartz in the land or running water. And, this is something that, of course, we don't completely understand scientifically at this point, but it certainly seems to indicate that there's something about some of these properties that are conducive to the activity, whether it's causing a residual recording to play back easier because there's limestone in the foundation, or whether it's a conscious entity that is somehow utilizing the flow of water to move its own energy. It's, those are all fascinating theories, and all we can do is continue to collect data and look at those situations. But certainly there are a lot of dynamics at the Sweet Springs location. And of course, again, we're not talking about native burial land. Let me be clear about that, because that's the old cliche,
right,
but
right.
Of course, most of the land in this country, all land in this country, was originally native owned. And some of these locations, I think, if you start digging into some of the native history in the region, you can find some interesting things. Now, I've only found a couple of scattered things about that particular location in terms of Native American history. But I know from other experiences, I've found places where, for instance, there was high activity, and maybe the natives of the region considered that a taboo area, because even they said there was something weird or strange that happened on the property. So, I think there's likely something going on this location in West Virginia.
So are you talking an area of physical conflict or spiritual conflict when it comes to Native Americans?
Sometimes both. Yeah.
Sometimes both. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we'll leave that for the DVD. But it's interesting that you say, because you do have different areas of conflict. And I guess the best parallel I can pull is that, and I can throw this in there too. I know I'm getting a little convoluted here, but there are, when you say spiritual conflict, I know, like, say with the Palmer House, the rumor is in the basement that that may be a Pukwudgie down there in the basement, or an elemental spirit, which a lot of times are, you know, when you run into spirits that may not be completely human or may be an elemental spirit, it's a different type of haunting or a different way to try and attack an investigation, along with all the different possible tragedy that you may be running into, especially with a tuberculosis hospital. It kind of may throw some mixed signals, and that's what I think probably makes for an interesting DVD. Did you find yourself a little mixed up at times, especially if you have different histories crossing over each other?
At that location, in some ways, you know, we had those experiences. It was really fascinating. And as much as you try to go into a location without a predetermined sense of what's going to happen, you know, it's often difficult. When you step into a place like this that has such a rich history, you know, you can't help but think about the historical figures, for instance, that have you know, stepped over the location that you're standing in. You know, you're maybe walking in the footsteps of Thomas Jefferson or something. So, you know, that's always in the back of your mind, and you're thinking, okay, well, what's, you know, what's going to come up? You know, is there going to be, you know, indications of that, or, you know, phantoms from that or that period or what? And then you get into this place, and it's often it's something completely different out of left field. It's interesting you talk about elementals, because we experienced something very bizarre in this location that is, I personally think that it's something that goes back to the natives that were on the land. And whether it's an elemental or some kind of bizarre guardian or what it is, I'm not sure. But I can tell you this, during the investigation, all three of us independently saw what appeared to be glowing red eyes from the height of something that would be about the size of a dog or a large wolf. And the intriguing thing about that is that we saw it in different locations. We tried, again, every way to determine that there was something that, you know, could explain that, and there wasn't. But Tim, the creepiest thing, hands down, that happened was actually at the end of the last evening that we were there filming and investigating. We were actually packing all the equipment up. We had left some pieces of equipment up on the third floor, and we had all had very odd experiences in the hallway up on that floor. It's where a lot of the residential area, they called it, you know, they had converted those into single rooms during the retirement period. And even during the time it was a TB hospital, they were individual rooms up there. But there was something very kind of unsettling about one of the hallways at the top of the stairs. And we had started gathering the equipment up. We told Sean Austin, he's going to give me grief for saying this, but we told Sean to go up to the third floor and get this equipment, and he was very reluctant to do so. And, you know, didn't want to go himself, and because of the intense experiences we had up there. So I was like, oh man, I don't have time for this. So I went up and went up to these steps, and Sean had actually come right behind me. You know, I guess he just didn't want to go up himself. But we reached the top of those stairs, and just as I opened the door to go into the hallway, I swung that door open, and right before I stepped through, Sean was right behind me, we both heard this loud growl. And it was it was so loud that Dave Spinks, who was all the way downstairs, heard it echo down the halls.
Wow.
Down the stairwells. And, you know, of course, gave a very colorful statement asking what it was. And, you know, it was really creepy. It really was just a creepy experience. And it sort of coincided with what we had experienced previous times up there investigating, with what sounded like, for all intents and purposes, a large canid sort of scuffling around in that section of the hallway. And, you know, two of us had seen red eyes up there in that hallway and then hearing this animal sound. And honestly, I was the first person who heard it up there. And I thought, okay, this sounds loud, but it's probably echoing. It's got to be, you know, like a raccoon or, you know, something that has gotten into, you know, inside and is scrounging around. So we searched high and low that night and the next day during the day, just looking for any kind of trace of animals being up there. And, you know, aside from some birds and, you know, some squirrels in one area or something, there was nothing in that particular area where the sound was coming from. And it got to where it was very distinctive. You know, if you have dogs, you know, which I do, you know what it sounds like when dogs are walking across a tile floor,
right?
You know, when they're scuffling around and moving and so forth. And that is what it sounded like. It sounded like a large dog. And at one point, you know, a couple of times we even saw sort of a shadow figure that was animal in size. Again, like a large canid moving in that hallway. So very, very strange experience and something completely unexpected given the history that we did know about the location.
You mentioned that you think it might have been elemental, but I had a similar experience at Waverly along with Chip Coffee and about 10 other people in the bloodletting room at Waverly. And it was that exact same experience with that audible canid growl.
Well,
yeah. And I didn't see any red eyes. But I heard it and Chip was behind me and I turned around and I looked at him and I asked him if he was screwing with me. And a lady said, no, I heard it too.
Yeah.
And at that point, we all got chills like, ooh, okay. Because I thought he was just screwing around with me, trying to freak me out or whatever. When the lady said, no, I heard it too, that's when the hairs go up on the back of the neck, you know, and you go, oh, geez.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, at that point, you question, what was it exactly that I just heard? And then, of course, at that point, like you said, you look around, you start looking for small animals, or you start looking for other things that potentially might have got in. But yeah, at that point you start asking, what did I just hear, and what type of creature could it be, you know? And if it is from the other side, what type of creature am I hearing? That's a good question. You know, especially when you're dealing with a building that has multiple hauntings and has had multiple histories that are stacked one on top of the other. I guess that leads to my next question, which is, when, as a seasoned investigator, when you're in a building like that, how do you separate one history from another in what you may be dealing with? Because I know sometimes you can't, but what is your reasoning of deduction when you have an experience like that? How do you start weeding out one from another as to what it is you just experienced?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, you have to be conscious in a situation like that, that you are likely dealing with layers, you know, layer upon layer of history, obviously, but potentially layer upon layer of the hauntings or the energy that's there that you're dealing with. So the best you can do really is to try to deal with that type of phenomena in an isolated sense. And you have to try to understand, you know, first of all, collect the data and look at the experience and the information you gather from it and try to determine, okay, is there any logical connection here to anything that we know about that went on in the building? And if not, you know, does this connect in any way to anything that could potentially be here? And in, you know, when we're getting something like that, it's kind of, it's mind-boggling, it's fascinating, and it really confounds you to a degree because you have to just think, you know, what in the world? You know, obviously this is not a location that had a bunch of dogs running around for any reason. You know, they didn't have dogs there during the time it was a TB hospital or anything like that. So, you know, where in the world could this potentially come from? It's very difficult to determine. And that actually was one of the reasons I had sort of defaulted back to a potential connection to the Native American period on the land, because there was some talk about a guardian or protector spirit on that land that maybe was a type of canid. And that gets really intriguing for me.
That is very intriguing. You know, one of the chapters that sits at that property at Sweet Springs that I guess to me is sad yet intriguing, which was the same for me at Waverly, is a tuberculosis hospital. And you know, it is a sad chapter, I guess, in our country's history at a lot of different locations. In Sweet Springs history, and I don't know how much you got to delve into the actual records of patients that would have been there, but were there some stories attached to the property that kind of made you either disheartened or maybe cringe a little bit as to, you know, that could have been attached to hauntings that you went, you know what, I don't know that I want to run into this haunting at this time, having to do with a patient that might have been sick there?
Yeah, there wasn't anything particular like that in this location. And part of the reason is, of course, a large portion of the history of this place has been sort of lost or at least forgotten at this point. So until someone really digs in, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time for someone to dig into the physical history of that location. And, you know, honestly, it's like a lot of other historical buildings like that, Tim. We'll never know a lot of the stories that unfolded behind those doors, just because, you know, due to the time period or whatever, it was never recorded or never talked about. So, you know, there wasn't, at least at this point, there hasn't been any particularly disturbing, you know, singular account or anything like that that came out of that hospital that we know of. Now, we certainly had a lot of strange things coming across EVP, and you know, we used some of the ghost boxes. We had strange things coming across those and other various pieces of equipment, and you know, some of it was pretty fascinating. There's a whole story that actually is not, I don't think it made the cut on the DVD simply because it is very adult in nature.
Oh.
But let me just say that one of the female spirits that was communicating was very fond of Sean.
Really?
And
well, he is quite the good looking chap, I guess.
Wanted to get much more familiar with him than she was already. and was making very lewd suggestions. And and of course, that was very entertaining for Dave Spinks and myself. You know?
Did he blush at all?
Well, Sean has great reactions. I mean, he gets very shocked at these kind of things to a degree, and you know, gets the kind of what the, you know, response. But it was, man, we had such a good time investigating this place, and for Dave, being a West Virginia native, you know, this was sort of a dream location for him because he had tried years ago to get into it, and of course, when the state owned it, they wouldn't let anybody in to do something like that, and you know, there was just no chance. So it was a pretty incredible experience. And of course, being the first team to go in there and conduct a full investigation, man, that was, you know, we were quite happy with that too. And of course, we live streamed some of the investigation on our YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result, I guess one of the television shows, you know, got wind of it and got themselves in there. Which, is, as far as I know, hasn't aired yet. But
I was going to say that's the next. That's kind of the next frontier. Is now you're going to have television shows that are going to kind of storm the bridge there, and you're also going to have investigators that are going to want to know when they can get in there as well. Are you afraid that this is going to become a territory that's going to, I guess, get overrun and a little bit abused?
I don't think it is, and I'll tell you why. It's a board that controls what's going on with the property. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that they had given us permission to conduct the investigation for a few days, purportedly a couple of the board members were not happy about some of the negative things that manifested during our investigation. Hmm. So they got very upset about that and decided that there wouldn't be any more investigations in there. And of course, you know, a television show comes calling and they say, well, we'll let them in there. So the show got in, but it's not, I think it's going to stand for quite some time that we're the ones who did the most work in there and did the most thorough investigation at this point. And they're actively working to refurbish the site and get it opened again for the public. So until that time, I doubt that many people are going to be in there investigating, if anyone else. As I said, the board is pretty reluctant to do anything with it at this point. So I'm sure, you know, the next wave after it's more nationally known, there'll be more people trying to get in. But it seems like, at least at this point, it's still going to be very limited how much is done on the site. And, you know, for us, it was very much perfect timing because we got in just as activity was starting to stir in the location. And, of course, that frequently, you know, causes the dynamic to change, as we know. So perfect timing for us to do the location. And, you know, I'd like to readdress it someday, but we'll see what happens with the site. If they actually gather all the funds they need to completely refurbish it, then that alone could kick up a whole different level of activity. There's no telling.
That's curious that they think that they can control ghosts and make it PR friendly.
I know.
that boggles my mind. And they're not the first board to think that they can do that. That's the funny thing.
I know. And there was a couple things. You know, there was an incident because there were three of us and we were trying to cover a lot of territory. There were times when we were doing solo sessions in different parts. And there was a whole segment where Dave Spinks was down in the main entryway near the Jefferson fireplace. We had set up a control center there one of the nights, and he had – Sean and I were both in other areas of the building, and Spinks turned on one of the – I think he turned on a hack shack, and these voices started coming across telling him to use a Ouija board. Now, Dave is one of these people who's very opposed to anything related to the Ouija board, and it's – it's both kind of creepy and, for me, a little bit entertaining that this whole dialogue unfolded with Spinks and this ghost box and this something arguing with him to use a Ouija board, you know, and trying to convince him, you know, come on, just use the board, use the Ouija board. and him arguing that he's not going to do it. And, of course, he was pretty fascinated by it and was trying to get some answers, but also, of course, a little creeped out, you know, because – you know, who knows what it is trying to get him to use a Ouija board.
Yeah,
so
just trying to, you know, open things, the, you know, seventh like level to hell, that's all. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Why not? You know, I'll give you answers, but, you know, let's open up hell on earth first. Why not?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And of course, Dave wouldn't do it, right?
No, he wouldn't do it. So.
Ah, chicken. So you got one pretty boy who didn't want to go upstairs and deal with the demons. You got another who didn't want to open the seventh layer of hell. Who are you investigating with, David? Jeez, you need a tougher crew, man. That's what it comes down to.
Oh, you can't really get much of a tougher crew. I tell you, the places, particularly that Spinks and I have been in, you know, we've been in a lot of places that other people have run out of. So, you know, I don't really hesitate for things like that. I think the Ouija board is probably Spinks's one line in the sand he won't cross. You know, he won't mess with that thing. He's done other investigations where people were using one, and, you know, he's been in on the investigation or something, but it's just, you know, his personal belief system, and I respect that. He just doesn't cross that line. So, you know, that's the way it is.
Let me ask you, David, have you used one?
Oh, I've used Ouija boards before, yeah.
And you're not afraid of them at all?
I used them when I was a kid. So, you know, I have a whole different theory on Ouija boards. You know, a lot of it's always a bit humorous to me that people grant Ouija boards so much power. Mm-hmm. You know, usually people who are staunch Christians, you know, and they want to argue about how it's the, you know, the devil's tool and so forth. And the thing is that why are you giving a piece of wood that much power?
Yeah.
Now, I do firmly believe that there are dangers in using the Ouija board, because what happens is that so many people, you know, you hear all these stories. You know, I can't tell you, Tim, how many stories I've heard about the Ouija board that wouldn't burn or wouldn't break or anything else. And my first response to those people telling me the story is always, bring it to me. Mm-hmm. I want to see that board. I want to see that board. Yeah. You know, give it to me. I'll take it. And you know, no one has yet to produce one of those for me. It's always a friend of a friend story, or, you know, I finally got rid of it or something like that. But to look at the other side, what you have a lot of times is, you know, teenagers or preteens who get a hold of these boards and they sit down with it because of the idea that it is a way to communicate with spirits, or that it's something, you know, satanic or whatever. And what do they do, Tim? This goes back to our discussion about the black-eyed kids in a way. Mm-hmm. What do these kids do? They sit down with this board and they make a statement like, anyone who's here can come and communicate.
Right.
Whoa. You just flung the door wide open, mm-hmm. with no parameters, no protections, nothing else. So you've now let whatever wants to enter, and you don't know how to control that dynamic or how to protect yourself or anything else. So that, I think, is where the danger of the Ouija board lies.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, quite honestly, anytime we're getting into communications with spirits, you have to take precautions. There are things you have to do on a personal level, I believe, because, you know, I've known people that have gotten obsessed with EVPs, and they sit around in their home, you know, collecting EVPs all the time, or running, you know, hat shacks or Frank's boxes or whatever. And that, too, is dangerous.
Yep.
You know, you're not creating any kind of barriers or protections or anything else. So we're on a whole different topic here, but it's anyway. There's such a long answer on Ouija boards.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. It is dangerous to kind of sit open and invite whatever it is that's going to come in. You're absolutely right on that point. So I guess in closing here, David, you've got two projects out there right now. You've got the revised Black Eyed Children book, and that's available where right now? Is that available on Amazon.com and all different?
Amazon.com, yeah.
Okay, and we'll have a link up for that. And then The Haunting of Sweet Springs, this DVD you said is coming out now here within the next 7 to 10 days or so?
It's probably the next 7 to 10 days that'll be available, and there will be links. We'll eventually get that on a digital platform. It's just in DVD form at the moment, and there'll be links for that on my blog, twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com, as well as Dave Spink's website, and the Society of Supernatural has a Facebook page, so please check that out. Like and follow that, and you'll get updates on different projects, because we do have some other things coming out this year under that banner. And then for myself personally, I have a number of projects lined up. It's going to be both a very busy and a very big year. So I'm really excited about 2018.
All right. We'll have those links up as well in the description of this show at podcastone.com. And, of course, in the download of this show, the description of the download of this show as well. And be sure to check out in that next 7 to 10 days the DVD. Pick up a copy of the DVD. It's called The Haunting of Sweet Springs, Weird West Virginia, with David Weatherly and Dave Spinks. David, I want to thank you once again for giving us a portion of your time. I know it's very valuable and in short supply, and we always enjoy having you aboard, my friend, and getting a bit of your time to talk about these topics.
Hey, always a pleasure, man. Thanks.
We want to encourage everybody to have a safe weekend and an enjoyable weekend. And Monday is Parashare and Supernatural News. If you have a story you want to share with us, be sure to email it to dave@darknessradio.com, and we will get it on the air. We will be sure to dig up a bunch of strange and supernatural stories for you for Monday as well. Some weird, wacky ones as well, as Dave is back on Monday. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. This has been the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.